afternoon and tomorrow, right?
Oh yeah, and many more to come. And yeah, stay tuned to KBOO. KBOO is an excellent community resource. This is your clearinghouse for just everything possible. You just keep listening, have that KBOO on all the time, anytime you get a chance. And yeah, you can also go to the keepnestleout.wordpress.com. That's the Keep Nestle Out of the Gorge coalition page. That would be keep Nestle out all one word .wordpress.com.
And there we go. That's what I was waiting for. That's a great Sesame Street song. God, I love this song. Thanks, Matthew.
Thanks, Paul.
All right.
Ice and snow. It is 9 a.m. and you do have it tuned to KBOO in Portland. And as Paul told you a few minutes ago, at 9, we are going to have a program with human rights lawyer Gabriela Rivera and Kelsey Alfu Jones of the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission, USA, about the legacy of sexual violence in Guatemala, that is, political perspectives. And the second part of Political Perspectives at 9:30 is Anti-War Radio with Scott Horton, who interviews veteran journalist Seymour Hersh about his recent article about revisiting the Malay massacre 47 years after his report revealed it. And then, of course, you want to stay tuned at 10 for Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints. Features coverage of yesterday's Stop Police Violence actions, and we hear an excerpt from a talk by writer Eduardo Galeano, who died this week. And at 11, it's the KBOO Food Show with Chris Siegel and Rachel Bennett. So you're going to want to listen to all of the morning on your community radio station. And thank you, members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can still become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Yeah, this message before we go to Political Perspectives.
Oh, I got a home, I'm just rambling around.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, happening Tuesday the 21st from 5:30 to 7:45 p.m. at the Central Library in downtown Portland, and Sunday the 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the North Portland Library. The Portland Renters Assembly is a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right. There'll be a chance for individuals to tell their stories about skyrocketing rents, no-cause evictions, dubious fees, and other kinds of exploitation carried out in the name of rent. There'll be childcare, snacks, and a chance to get connected to resources for moving forward together. For more information about the Portland Renters Assembly, go to kboo.fm and click on the right side for community events.
Tune in Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes. Swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Political Perspectives. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and in studio with me is Gabriela Rivera, who is a human rights lawyer and lead attorney for the well-known Sepper Zarco case defending the victims of sexual violence at the hands of the Guatemalan military in the early 1980s. Gabriela Rivera works at the Association of Women Transforming the World, a part of the Alliance for Breaking the Silence and Ending Impunity. Gabriela Rivera, welcome to KABU. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Also with us is Kelsey Alford Jones, who is the executive director of the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission USA. They are sponsoring Gabriela Rivera's tour, and she is in Portland with her. Thank you for coming in, Kelsey.
Thank you so much.
And let me say that Gabriela will be speaking this evening at 6:30 p.m. at the World Affairs Council of Oregon. That's at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue. And tomorrow, she and Kelsey will be at the University of Portland, which is at 5000 North Willamette Boulevard. After their Portland tour, they'll be going to the Washington, D.C. area to some events there. Gabriela, can you start by giving us some, well, actually, maybe Kelsey wants to answer this question, some historical context on this issue of sexual violence against women in Guatemala in the early 1980s. What was happening at that time? Either one of you who wants to address that would be great. Is it you, Kelsey?
Sure. I can give a brief overview, and then Gabriela can add in. Guatemala suffered a intensely violent internal armed conflict in the last century. It lasted from 1960 to 1996. And this was a period in which the Guatemalan government, the Guatemalan military, and paramilitary forces, with the backing and full support of the U.S. government, carried out a campaign of widespread violence, torture, sexual violence, forced disappearances, and massacres against a civilian unarmed population, the majority of whom were indigenous Guatemalans. And the justification for this tremendous violence was addressing the communist threat in Guatemala. This was happening in the context of the Cold War. And indigenous Guatemalans were identified as an internal enemy of the state. And particularly in the early 1980s, what that meant was that the Guatemalan army carried out a scorched earth campaign, coming into Mayan villages, burning down homes, burning crops, stealing or killing livestock, often raping women, and in many, many, many cases, massacring the communities. Over the course of these 36 years of war, there were over 600 massacres and over 400 villages that were essentially wiped off the map. There were two Truth Commission reports that came out at the after the signing of the peace accords. And the UN report found that there were about 200,000 people who were killed, the vast majority unarmed civilians and indigenous Guatemalans. They found that there were about 1 million internally displaced people and a couple of 100,000 people who had fled to southern Mexico and to the U.S. There were about 45,000 people who were forcibly disappeared, the vast majority of whom to this day have not been found. And they also found that there was widespread use of sexual violence as a tool of war. However, in those reports, they didn't really ask much about that. They heard about it maybe from a few testimonies. But it's not until today, almost 18 years after the signing of the peace accords, that we're really beginning to understand the full extent of the use of sexual violence, the way that women's bodies were used as a battlefield to control, to sow fear into communities. And that's what this case that Gabriela and her organization is working on is helping to show. And these terrible atrocities, some of which, according to the UN, constituted acts of genocide against the Mayan people, have not found justice in Guatemalan courts. There are very few cases that have moved forward in the courts. And so right now in Guatemala, one of the biggest human rights struggles is the search for justice. And the people moving these cases forward oftentimes are women. And so this case also is an emblematic case, not only because it is the first case really about sexual violence in Guatemala, but it's also moved forward 100% by women. It's an inspiring case, and I'll let Gabby expand on that. But this is the the legacy of the war in Guatemala is present today. It defines so much of what happens. And it's important to understand the war in order to understand what's happening now.
Yes, pretty much as Kelsey was saying, when the truth commissions were working, they really focused a lot on sexual violence. And it wasn't only because of some women were willing to speak about this, that in practically a final moment, both truth reports added some chapters on sexual violence. So as you can imagine, it's very difficult for women to speak about sexual slavery, sexual violence. So it is not only after 3 decades, practically, that these women are finally feeling ready to look for justice. They had never stopped looking for justice and looking for their disappeared husbands. But now they are really trying to push the legal system in Guatemala to finally work for them.
And what are the ages of this group of women? What's the age range in them now? They must be middle-aged.
Well, when the events of the Sepur Zarco case happened during 1982 and 1983, these 15 women that are pushing the Sepur Zarco case were the wives of locals that were seeking to get the legal property of their lands they lived in, because the big landowners in the area were always trying to take away lands from the local communities. So their husbands were going to the city with very few resources, not speaking Spanish very well, to try to get their papers to own their lands. For doing this, their husbands were targeted as subversive and communist and guerrillas just for speaking up for their rights. They were targeted by the huge landowners in the area. And so the army detained them illegally and disappeared them. So these women were in their 30s and 40s even, and now when their husbands were disappeared, they were left with their children. And after that, was it that they were forced by the members of the military to move around a military post located in Sepur Zarco, where they were being held slaved, and they suffered from sexual and domestic slavery for periods from 4 months to 10 months. So now these women are in their 70s. Mm-hmm. One of them is in their 80s. They only speak their Mayan Quechua language. They don't speak Spanish. They live in extremely difficult conditions, economic conditions. The system has really never worked for them, but they are still trying to push it.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, Gabriella. What is the momentum, or what is the case like at this point? What is going on with this case?
Yeah, well, the case started when these women were trying to reach out to some organizations. In general, it was a bigger group of women, about 100 women, that started to talk about sexual violence in 2008 and 2009. So there was an alliance that was formed by 3 organizations: Mujeres Transformando el Mundo, or Women Transforming the World, which is the one I work for. It's mainly a lawyers organization. There was another organization called ECAP that provides with the psychological support, and another organization called UNAMGE, which is in charge of the political part of the case. So at that moment, the organizations really didn't have much, the conditions were not given for having a fair trial or a thorough investigation. But then, when Claudia Paz y Paz became Attorney General, she was the first woman Attorney General in Guatemala, she just gave the instruction to the prosecutors to investigate these cases, which is like the normal thing to do. But before her, there really was not much investigation of human rights violation during the internal armed conflict. So the investigation moved forward from 2011, where the former complaint was presented, And in 2012, these women gave their testimonies before a judge for the first time. And last year, on June last year, we made the first two arrests. And right now, we are just waiting for the date of the start of the trial.
And even as we speak, your fellow lawyers are in court about this.
Yes, there's a hearing today, and we hope it can move forward to the judge given the date for the start of the trial.
So let's talk a little bit about something that you mentioned, Kelsey, and that is sort of how this whole period of time and these events that have happened in Guatemala in the early 80s have influenced what's happening in Guatemala now. What is the impact of what happened in the 80s to the situation there now?
That's a very complex question. Okay. But I think the state structure that was set up during the internal armed conflict was one that was working to guarantee, that the state would control everything, and not just not a democratic state, but a state that was repressive, and that was violently attacking anyone who expressed different views. And that structure remains in place today. State institutions, on the one hand, are broke. They're very corrupt. There's a lot of evidence of infiltration of organized criminal elements and parallel power structures embedded within the Guatemalan state. And that is a holdover from the war. A lot of the power structures that were formalized during the war, when the war ended, maintained their power even though they no longer legally were in control. And that is seen in the immense impunity in the Guatemalan justice system. For example, a lot of the high-ranking military officials who planned and ordered a lot of these human rights violations remain in government in Guatemala. In fact, the current president was in the military in the region where the genocide occurred at the time that the genocide occurred. So you can only imagine that he is not very excited about cases like this moving forward in Guatemalan courts. And so there has been kind of widespread efforts from both the Guatemalan government as well as parallel power structures to ensure impunity for the actions committed during the internal armed conflict. At the same time, as we mentioned, that those working for change, working to legalize their land, working to fight for indigenous rights, working to fight for student rights or women's rights or any rights, were declared as enemies of the state. And that mentality also remains in Guatemala today. In indigenous communities where people continue that struggle to maintain control or gain legal control of their land, they are targeted as terrorists, as sometimes even the same words from the 1980s are used, communists, guerrilla. And there have been a series of cases where communities have been violently evicted with heavy presence of kind of a militarized police force or the military itself, where houses have been burned, crops have been burned. I mean, the same pattern of kind of violent repression against indigenous communities continues today. Those who are working from organizations, human rights organizations, to improve the situation for different communities in Guatemala are often the victims of threats and attacks, and in some cases assassinations. And just the last couple of months, three different community activists in different parts of the country have been assassinated for their work publicly to oppose large-scale transnational projects such as hydroelectric dams and mines in Guatemala. So the general sense of the fear of speaking out remains. State repression remains as a tactic to address dissent and social protest. And the same barriers remain for Guatemalans, particularly indigenous Guatemalans and even more than that, indigenous women in Guatemala, barriers to access education, health services, legal ownership of their land, and the ability to access the justice system.
And that is one of the most interesting things about this case, because in that context of very difficult access to justice and just absence of the state for these women, they can really see how the conditions that fuel the internal armed conflict are not that different now from what it happened in the 70s and 80s in Guatemala. So that is always, and they remind us to the organizations all the time, that their goal and their objective of doing this and taking this case and moving forward in justice is to do whatever it's in their power to prevent these things from happening again. They are terrified that these things are going to happen. They saw their whole communities suffering, men being tortured, people being executed, disappeared, women suffering from sexual violence. So the conditions, since the conditions are not that different, they really want to make sure to speak up so that this don't happen again. This doesn't happen.
I'm speaking with Gabriela Rivera, who is a human rights lawyer and lead attorney for the Sepper Zarco case, defending the victims of violence at the hands of the Guatemalan military. And also we are speaking with Kelsey Alfred Jones, who is the executive director of the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission USA. And they will be at the World Affairs Council this evening at 6:30 p.m. And I wanted to ask about, you mentioned, Kelsey, that the U.S. government was a backer of the military, the Guatemalan military, that committed these acts. What do you think the responsibility of the U.S. is as it relates to what's happening in Guatemala today?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important that we remember and that we talk about the role that the U.S. played throughout this period of funding, training, backing, and supporting the Guatemalan military in every step of the way. And we know now from declassified documents and from reports that have come out the level of involvement that the U.S. had. And it's not unique in Guatemala. We've seen it across the region. But there is an immense amount of responsibility that the U.S. played and that we have now to address these issues. One of the things that the U.S. has been doing in a limited sense has been supporting some of these transitional justice cases in Guatemala. But ultimately, when we look at U.S. policy in the region, when we look at our economic policies, the free trade agreement that we've signed with the region, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, when we look at the security policies that we are promoting in the region, we are continuing to perpetuate a system which continues to propel conditions of poverty, impoverishment, I should say, forced migration, and ultimately continues a context in which indigenous Guatemalans, poor Guatemalans, and Guatemalans who are fighting for their rights are victimized by the Guatemalan state. And so there, too, we have an immense amount of both responsibility and opportunity to look at our policies and how they're affecting the country. Right now, what's being discussed in Washington, D.C., is this $1 billion aid package to the region to address the forced migration issue and coming out of the kind of wave of unaccompanied minors that came to the U.S. Last summer. Unfortunately, when you look at the plan that's being proposed, it's increased border security, kind of this militarized model that we're also seeing reflected here in the United States, kind of promoting transnational investment and large-scale development projects, which in Guatemala have a history of violence against the population, forced evictions, and et cetera. So our policies are not promoting a sustainable local development that can really lead people to improve their lives and create conditions where people can stay in their communities. Our policies, unfortunately, are perpetuating a cycle in which people are forced to migrate because of the conditions they're living in.
And what do you want people to understand about the people who are forced to migrate here? And, you know, there's been a recent publicity about women, young women crossing the border. What do you want people to understand about that from the perspective of your organizations and the work you're doing?
Well, one thing is to understand that it is incredibly difficult to get to the U.S. People risk their lives to come here. Many, many, many people die en route to the United States. In Mexico, they face extortion, organized criminal violence, sexual violence at incredibly high rates. You know, most women that migrate assume that they will be raped. Or know that it is a very strong possibility. There are massacres that have happened in the last couple of years of migrants in Mexico. And then they get to the U.S. and they're crossing a desert in which thousands of people have died. They're facing in tremendously difficult conditions. This is not a vacation trip that people take. They're making this trip because they see no other option, and they're literally willing to risk their lives to come here to find conditions in which they may be able to feed their family and send a little bit money home to improve the conditions in which their families are living. Many people are coming because they're fleeing violence. Women who are facing tremendous domestic violence or sexual violence at the hands of organized criminal groups. Young people whose families have disintegrated in part because of the legacy of the internal armed conflict or because of other violence today. Young men who see that as the only way to continue supporting their family. Many of these people, particularly from Guatemala, are coming from very poor indigenous regions. And they do not have a state that will protect their interests and that will support them. And so I think the first thing that people should understand is this element of desperation, that it's a forced migration, that many people would much rather be at home in their communities, in their families. Guatemalans have a tremendously strong connection to their land. And so having compassion, I think, is incredibly important, and understanding the risks people take to come here. And then also understanding, again, the role that the U.S. is playing in perpetuating this. It's not something that's going to stop until the underlying kind of structural conditions change.
Mm-hmm. And Gabi, we just have a few minutes left, but what do you feel is most important for people to understand about what's going on in the work you're doing?
Well, I guess it's always important for Guatemalan people when a broader audience, an international audience, can understand that the conditions in other countries can be very different from their own. It's also very important to understand that when you listen to, when you read to the news or watch the TV and you see how the news are presented, it's not always necessarily like that. Usually the mass media discourse is it can be very different from reality. So it is important to get informed on several different sources of information. Solidarity is also very important. For example, not too many of these transitional justice cases, criminal cases, have moved forward in Guatemala. Hundreds of thousands of human rights violations occurred during the internal armed conflict, but not even 10 cases have gotten to trial in Guatemala. And these cases really don't move forward if they don't have a lot of support from the international community. So it's always very important to remember that the international pressure on the government can mean a lot for a small country like Guatemala. And just solidarity. When the whole government structure doesn't respond to you, even individual solidarity towards person looking for justice or whose security is under threat can mean a lot. So it is very important. And I would really invite you to follow up on the Sepúr Zarco case, to look for the Mujeres Transformando el Mundo webpage, and just follow up on whatever happens. This is, the women call this the path of justice, because when the justice system is not that reliable. Really, the whole process is important, and it's very important to have the support of the international community.
Great. And quickly, we just have a minute, but how would people find out more? What are the websites that they might go to?
Yes, for Mujeres Transformando el Mundo, it is www.mujerestransformandoelmundo.org. So I will leave you the address, so maybe you can share it through your social network. And that's our hashtag, Sepur Sarco.
Sarco. Sarco is Z-A-R-C-O?
Yes.
That's the title of the case that we're talking about, Z-A-R-C-O, so people would know. Any others you want to recommend, Kelsey?
Sure. If people are interested in learning more about the work of GHRC, it's www.ghrc-usa.org. And we have a listserv. We have a lot of information online and through social media, so we invite you to find us there.
Great. That was Kelsey Alford-Jones. Also with us was Gabriela Rivera. Thank you both for coming in, and thank you for your work. And they will be at the World Affairs Council at 6:30 this evening. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. This program will be available on our website in a little while. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for the second part of Political Perspectives.
Okay, next up is Anti-War Radio with Scott Horton here on your community radio station, KABU.
I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Seymour Hersh on his new piece, Returning to the Scene of the Crime. Introducing the great Seymour Hersh from the New Yorker magazine, the man who broke the story of the My Lai Massacre back in 1969, and now he's got a brand new one in the New Yorker about it called The Scene of the Crime, about his recent return there. Welcome back to the show, Cy. How are you?
Okay.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. Now, listen, we got a real young audience here, and this whole thing happened even before I was born, so can we start, please, with maybe just sort of a small review of